Zion, Shabbat, from Mom's departed, Charya Shtota, this is the Sikhima. His Divine Grace, Shri A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami, Shri Prabhupada Ki. Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Paravija Kacharya Ashto Tadasita Sri Shimad. His Divine Grace, Shri Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anandapati Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. ISKCON, BBT Founder Acharya, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Namacharya, Shri Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Jagaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Chamakun Radha Kun Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Shri Mayapur Navadip Dham Ki Jai. Tulasi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Jamuna Maya Ki Jai. Ganga Maya Ki Jai. Shama Veda Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Adhyana Timirandasya Yanangan Salakaya Chakshurum Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Sichaitanya Manovishtam Shtapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Pitatmayam Dadati Shvabadati Tam Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Shimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Shunyavadi Paskatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaurabhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today we are going to read from First Canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 2, Text Number 16, which we have listed on the board here. Shushusho Shradanasya Vasudeva Katha Ruchi Syan Maha Sevaya Vipraha Punya Tirtha Nushevana Shushusho Shradanasya Vasudeva Katha Ruchi Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipraha Punya Tirtha Nishevana Shusho Shadadanasya Vasudeva Kataruji Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipraha Punya Tirta Nishevana Shusho Shadadanasya Vasudeva Kataruji Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipraha Punya Tirta Nishevana your glasses. One who is engaged in hearing.
One who is engaged in hearing.
Shadadanasya.
Shadadanasya.
With care and attention.
With care and attention.
Vasudeva.
Vasudeva.
In respect to Vasudeva.
In respect to Vasudeva.
Kata.
Kata.
The message.
The message.
Ruchi.
Ruchi.
Affinity.
Syat
is made possible.
Mahat Sevaya
by service rendered to pure devotees. Vipraha, O twice born. Punyatirta,
those who are cleansed of all vice.
Nishevana.
By service.
Translation of purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada.
O twice-born sages, by serving those devotees who are completely free from all vice, great service is done. By such service, one gains affinity for hearing the messages of Vasudeva. Please repeat.
O twice-born sages, by serving those devotees who are completely free from all vice, great service is done. By such service, one gains affinity for hearing the messages of Vasudeva.
The conditioned life of a living being is caused by his revolting against the Lord. There are men called Deva, or godly living beings, and there are men called Asuras, or demons, who are against the authority of the Supreme Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita, 16th chapter, a vivid description of the Asuras is given, in which it is said that the Asuras are put into lower and lower states of ignorance, life after life, and so sink to the lower animal forms and have no information of the absolute truth, the personality of Godhead. These asuras are gradually rectified to God consciousness by the mercy of the Lord's liberated servitors in different countries according to the supreme will. Such devotees of God are very confidential associates of the Lord. And when they come to save human society from the dangers of godlessness, they are known as the powerful incarnations of the Lord, as sons of the Lord, as servants of the Lord, or as associates of the Lord. But none of them falsely claim to be God themselves. This is a blasphemy declared by the Asuras, and the demoniac followers of such Asuras also accept pretenders as God or his incarnation. In the revealed scriptures, there is definite information of the incarnation of God. No one should be accepted as God or an incarnation of God unless he is confirmed by the revealed scriptures. The servants of God are to be respected as God by the devotees who actually want to go back to Godhead. Such servants of God are called Mahatmas or Tirthas, and they preach according to particular time and place. The servants of God urge people to become devotees of the Lord. They never tolerate being called God. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is God himself, according to the indication of the revealed scriptures, but he played the part of a devotee. People who knew him to be God addressed him as God, but he used to block his ears with his hands and chant the name of Lord Vishnu. He strongly protested against being called God, although undoubtedly he was God himself. The Lord behaved so to warn us against unscrupulous men who take pleasure in being addressed as God. The servants of God come to propagate God consciousness, and intelligent people should cooperate with them in every respect. By serving the servant of God, one can please God more than by directly serving the Lord. The Lord is more pleased when he sees that his servants are properly respected, because such servants risk everything for the service of the Lord and so are very dear to the Lord. The Lord declares in Bhagavad Gita 18:69 that no one is dearer to him than one who risks everything to preach his glory. By serving the servants of the Lord, one gradually gets the quality of such servants, and thus one becomes qualified to hear the glories of God. The eagerness to hear about God is the first qualification of a devotee eligible for entering the kingdom of God. Thus ends Prabhupada's purport. So I'd like to thank you all for making the great sacrifice to come here today. Because, as you know, today is a much publicized fight between Mani Pacman Pacquiao and Shane Mosley. I think that's why there are a few missing today, perhaps. But now we have Hakyo and Mosley versus Giridhari Swami. Who will win? All proceeds to go for the purchase of property and construction costs for a first-class temple complex for Shishi Radha Madhava. I hope you all buy tickets for that event. Anyway, jokes aside, I feel very blessed to be able to attend the program. After 5 years in exile, I consider every opportunity to associate with devotees and speak about Krishna as quite precious. As a famous musician once said, you don't know what you got until you lose it. So I lost this precious opportunity for several years, and by the mercy of the Vaishnavas, Guru and Krishna, I've been given a second chance. So I'm very full of gratitude for this opportunity. Now again, this verse that I've chosen today is, I would say, actually chosen by Srila Prabhupada himself. And how I'm saying that is that, again, in the series of lectures that I've been listening to on both Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada again and again refers to this verse. As I was speaking about the verse last week he was referring to, but in the past week, he keeps coming up with this particular verse. So I thought that it was quite appropriate that I should speak on this one. So getting right into the purport, the question is, why are we in the material world in the first place? And the simple answer to that question that we all know is that, as Prabhupada mentioned in the purport, is that we have willfully revolted against the Lord. We have misused our free will. That was our choice. Because with free will, we have a choice that we can either go towards Krishna or we can go towards Maya. We're always given that space that we can go either way. So the choice was ours. And anyway, somehow or another, a long, long time ago, we made that choice to rebel against Krishna. And here we are. We've popped into the material world from the spiritual world. As amazing as it seems, how we can leave Krishna's association and come to the material world. It really doesn't make any logical sense, but with our independence, we chose to do it. So now, the question is it Maya that's so strong, or is it that our determination was not strong enough? Because Prabhupada, he tells some story about this. And in the story, there is a guru and a disciple. So, of course, the guru is addressed Guru Dev, and the disciple is trying to get direction from this Guru Dev, what to do. So he first goes to the cottage of the guru and ask him. He said, Maya is so strong. How do I possibly get free from the grips of Maya? So the guru says, come back tomorrow at the same time and I'll give you the answer. So about 24 hours later, the disciple returns and knocks on the door of the cottage, and he hears no reply. So he's wondering what has happened. And then he keeps knocking and calling out, Gurudev! Gurudev! But then he hears from the back of the cabin, he hears this shouting. And it sounds like the voice of his Gurudev saying, let me go! Let me go! So then quickly he runs back thinking that someone has, you know, grabbed hold of his Gurudev or is abusing him or somehow attacking him. So he runs back. But then he sees this very curious sight. He sees that his guru is holding on to a tree branch with both hands, and he's off the ground. His feet are off the ground. He's hanging on the tree branch, and he's yelling, "Let me go! Let me go!" And the disciple is looking, and he thinks, "It's very strange." And then he asks his guru, "But Gurudev, I don't understand. You're saying, let me go, let me go, but it's you who are holding on to the tree branch. It's not the tree that's holding on to you." And then the guru took the opportunity to teach his lesson, which was that it's not that Maya is holding on to us, it's that we are holding on to Maya. So, and Prabhupada said this as well, when sometimes devotees would go and whine to him and say, "Oh Prabhupada, Maya is so strong. What can I do? I can't withstand the power of Maya." And so Prabhupada just, very strongly shot back and said, it's not that Maya is strong, he said that it is your purpose that is not strong. Meaning, your determination is not strong. So he chastised, said like this, saying that we have to be more determined. This is the main point. So, in the purport also, and this question came up last week actually, about what happens to persons who are not devotees, who are, caught in the material energy. What happens to such persons? The question was asked. And actually, Prabhupada, he answers that question in this purport, because when he speaks about the asuras, those of demoniac mentality, he says that their future is very dark. It's very dark. So, although we use these terms, sura and asura, sura meaning godly and asura meaning demoniac, I think it's safe to say that we all came from asuric backgrounds. Is there anybody here who thinks they came from asuric background? Anybody? Did you come from a God-conscious background? I mean, truly God-conscious background? No. Well, we are all addicted to so many sinful activities, so we're all basically asuras. It's only a question of degree. Maybe we're not like Ravana or Hiranyakashipu, but we were asuric to a certain degree, at least. So the Bhagavad Gita says, in the 16th chapter, it says that attaining repeated birth amongst a species of demoniac life, O son of Kunti, such persons can never approach me. Gradually they sink down to the most abominable type of existence. So that's the answer. That's what happens to the asuras. That's their destination. They'll go downwards, they'll be born in lower and lower species of life, and as the Brahma Samhita says, that the smallest form of life is the Indragopa germ. It's some very, very tiny, bacteria or something, very, very tiny, can't be seen with the naked eye. So the possibilities, are endless. And we see various creatures running around at different times, even unfortunately sometimes in our temples. And we could have certainly been in one of those forms. We've been in the form of the rat. We've been in the form of the cockroach. I'm sure that we've been in the form of the ant and so many other bodies we've taken. 8,400,000. There's a big variety there. So, but Prabhupada says that even for the asuras, even for one who is so fallen, and even if he's in, very low life, they can be rectified by the association of the Lord's pure devotees. He says it very clearly. And we can see what Prabhupada did. One person came with a few dollars in his pocket, the clothes in his back, a trunk full of books, and some of his typed manuscripts, and, you know, his little cooker that he used to cook his meals in. That was about it. And he came to the country, United States, didn't really know, had one acquaintance, started off in one place, and then eventually made it to New York. And simply by his association, simply by trying to execute the order of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and chanting Hare Krishna, he attracted persons. That is the power of the pure devotee, that he attracted persons. And not only did he attract a few persons, he attracted thousands of persons in the 12 years in which he went around the world traveling nonstop. He opened so many temples, he attracted so many devotees, he initiated so many of them, installed so many deities, and gave us so many different programs. That's just one pure devotee. But not just any pure devotee. He's a Shaktivesh avatar, empowered directly by the Lord to preach Lord Chaitanya's message. But the point is that by his association, he uplifted the persons who were in a very fallen condition and were addicted to all sinful activities, and he uplifted them to the platform of very sincere and saintly devotees. The purport mentions also that even though these devotees are so powerful and they're so pure, they remain without any false ego, and they remain as the humble servants of Krishna. They can never tolerate being called God. Because it's a problem in the Kali Yuga. The certain class of persons, the Mayavadis, Sunyavadis, you know, they think, Mayavadis particularly, think that they are God. But the pure devotee never tolerates being called God. And as Prabhupada mentioned, even Lord Chaitanya, who was God, he came in the role of a devotee. So those who knew that he was God and called him as such, he would block his ears, literally block his ears, it's mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he would say, Vishnu, 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 like that. He wouldn't tolerate it. Why? Because he was trying to teach us that there's no question of an ordinary human being becoming the Supreme Person. So Mayavada is actually a very ridiculous philosophy, or better, we should call it a fool-osophy. It's a philosophy for fools, because it makes no sense at all. Their premise is that at one point I was God, but now I have somehow become covered, and now I don't actually realize that I'm God. But through the process of whatever, I again will realize that I'm God. And sometimes they falsely think that they're liberated, and they will even address themselves, or address another sannyasi and say, Om Narayan Namaha. Right? All glories to you, Narayan. The other person says, all glories to you, Narayan. So we have many Narayans, many gods. But there's no logic to the whole thing. The definition of God is that he's a supreme being. And that means that all energies are emanating from him, and he has the ultimate control over all those energies. So it's impossible for one of his own energies to cover him to forget that he's a supreme person. So the point is that God is always God. God is always God. He never forgets. And therefore, Prabhupada, a little play on words, he said, God, G-O-D. And he said, if you reverse that, you will have D-O-G. Dog. So he said, God is always God, and dog is always dog. So, there's no logic. It's nonsense. But so many people believe it. It's amazing. And even though, I've seen this so many times where we give a lecture to a group of persons, and many of them are impersonalists, you know. And you speak the philosophy, you make it very clear that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And, you know, you quote many verses, and it's so clear what our philosophy is. And afterwards they'll say, yeah, that's the same thing we believe. But actually they believe that Brahman is supreme. Or they think that they are God or whatever. It's the hodgepodge of what is called Hinduism. They really don't understand. But I think it's the same thing. But anyway, the hardcore Mayavadis, they won't give this up. They won't give up this concept, no matter what. I remember years ago, a group of devotees, we were in Hong Kong, we went to a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, on one of the islands there, Lanzhou Island. They have a big monastery, I think it's called Thailand Monastery, huge, hundreds of monks, huge buildings, everything. So they invited us to come and do kirtan, because we had some mutual friends or something. They invited us to come. We did kirtan. And they liked the kirtan. And afterwards, they wanted to give us some Buddhist prasadam, whatever that is. So we just politely took a little bit of fruit like that. And then we started getting into a conversation. Like the head monk there was speaking with me. And so he said, can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy? I mean, how does it differ from Buddhism? So I said, the main difference is that in Buddhism, the ultimate is the void. It's the ultimate thing is to become void, become nothingness, nirvana, to become nothing, to dissolve into nothing. And in Krishna consciousness, the goal is to become the pure, eternal servitor of the Supreme Lord. So as soon as those words left my lips, this monk went mad. And he started shouting, "No! No! It cannot be!" He was so upset by the concept that we have to be eternal servitors of a supreme God. Oh, they hate that. They don't want that. They'd rather just dissolve and become nothing. Doesn't sound like a very nice way to go, but anyway, that's what they like. So then, these Mayavadis, they have this, there's something called knife and scissors philosophy, that we call it. The Mayavadis, they're so diehard that they just won't give this up, the Mayavad philosophy. And they will go to the last breath. And so Prabhupada told this story in which there were two persons, and they were arguing over how to cut a piece of paper. So one person was saying, you cut the piece of paper with the knife. And the other person was saying, no, you cut the piece of paper with the scissors. And so they got into this very strong fight. And they were fighting with each other. One was saying, scissors, no, knife, scissors, knife, scissors, knife. They're going on and on like this. And so finally, the person who said to cut the paper with the knife threw the person who said to cut the paper with the scissors, threw him into the ocean. And this person, apparently, according to the story, he didn't know how to swim. So he was bobbing up and down, he was struggling, but with his last breath, before he went under for the last time, he put his hands up and he went like this. Scissors. So that's a diehard Mayavadi. He won't give it up no matter what. We can only pray and never fall into that position. It's very pitiful. So therefore, we try to give people something of genuine value. So a real incarnation, according to our scriptures, has to have three qualities. Otherwise, it cannot be accepted as an incarnation. Nowadays, there's so many incarnations. Matter of fact, one of them recently died. You may have heard. Sai Baba, right? Recently died. He was in his 80s. God dies. Do we ever hear that God died? God gets old. He gets an old body and he dies. Doesn't sound like the definition of God that we know. Our definition is Navayovanam, that he's eternally youthful. Krishna never ages beyond 16 years. Even though he spent 125 years on this planet at about 5,000 years ago, he never looked and he never aged beyond youth, 16 years old, that was it. So, the three things are that the incarnation, he must be foretold in Scripture. This is the first point. His coming is foretold. In the Bhagavatam, we see that all the different incarnations, they're mentioned, the schedules, when they come, different yugas, different times in those yugas. We know Lord Chaitanya came 5,000 years ago. We know that the Kalki avatar comes at the end of the Kali Yuga, like this. It's all scheduled. So if someone's not foretold in Scripture, then we understand that he's not a genuine incarnation. Secondly, he has to have special bodily markings. Sometimes we'll see these pictures of Krishna's lotus hands or Krishna's lotus feet. And on those lotus hands and on those lotus feet are found the conch, the disc, the lotus, all kinds of different symbols. There are specific symbols on Krishna's hands and feet. There are specific symbols on Srimati Radharani's hands and feet. So, unless you have those symbols for real, not that you go and get a tattoo, but they're real symbols that don't wash off with water, then you cannot be a real incarnation. So you should ask the incarnation to show you, you may not want to, but you can ask him to show you his feet. If that's, of course, they may stink. So if they do, then just ask him to show you his hands. And you should see the symbols there. If they're not there, finished. The third thing is that he must perform some superhuman acts. It's like Krishna. What did Krishna do? He lifted the Govardhan Hill 7 days, 7 nights. Effortlessly, with one finger. Small finger. With the other hand, he was playing his flute. He was in a tree bunga. He was bent in three places, like that. He was standing effortlessly. Not like a weightlifter that's struggling, you know, like this, shaking because he's got 400 pounds or something there he's trying to hold up. Krishna was holding tons and tons and tons of Govardhan Hill just with a small finger, effortlessly. That's what God can do. Or God, like Krishna swallowed a forest fire. How many people you know can do that? Krishna weighted down Trinavarta, the whirlwind demon who came, swept him up high in the air, and Krishna made himself very heavy, and the demon fell down, crashed dead. So, this is what Krishna can do. This is what the Supreme Lord can do. So, that third quality, he must have, be able to perform superhuman, something beyond what humans can do. The prophet goes on the purport. He says that the pure devotees are called Mahatmas. Mahatmas. The word Mahatma literally means a great soul or a broad-minded soul. A great soul is broad-minded. Meaning that he's thinking about the welfare of all others. He doesn't think about his own welfare, but he's thinking about the welfare of others. So he's broad-minded. And the definition given in the Bhagavad Gita of the Mahatma is Mahatmanas tu mam parta daivim prakritim ashrita vajanti ananya manaso gyatva bhutatim avyayam. O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. So, speaking on this verse in one of the lectures I was listening to, Prabhupada, he said that one of the qualities of the Mahatma, or the main quality of the Mahatma, is that he is 24 hours a day engaged in the service of Krishna. It means there's no time that he's not engaged in the service of Krishna. So let us study Prabhupada and the way that he conducted his life. He rose early, about 1 a.m. in the morning, and he switched on a small light, opened up this big Sanskrit book with the commentaries of the Acharyas, took up his dictaphone, and he was translating, Gita, Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, his books like this, for many hours. And then he would chant, he would bathe, he would go for his walk. But even when he was walking, he was always preaching and talking about Krishna, or examples from nature he would give. I mean, one interesting one, when Prabhupada was walking in Venice Beach in California, they went to one park, and of course Prabhupada always had his cane. He was walking with his cane. I don't think he really needed the cane out, honestly, but because he was walking so much faster than any of the disciples who were, you know, a third of his age. But it was just there. So he used his cane. And he used to use it to point. So they came to one big tree. And at the bottom of the tree, there were some bird droppings, some bird stool. So Prabhupada took his cane and he pointed to those bird droppings. And he asked the disciples, "What does this mean?" And nobody could figure. They couldn't really figure it out. They came up with these. Well, they couldn't. They really couldn't understand what Prabhupada was trying to get at. And then Prabhupada gave them the answer. He said, "This proves that even the bird is attached to his house, because he's living in that nest in the tree." And the fact that there's so many bird droppings down here means that he's there. He's there most of the time. And therefore, he's attached to his house and his home and his family and everything else as much as anybody else in the material world. So Prabhupada was making his point. So it's said here that the servants of Krishna, they come to propagate Krishna consciousness, and intelligent persons should cooperate with them. Now, in this purport, there's a really nice kind of a description here in which Prabhupada kind of encapsulates the whole verse and the purport and gives us, a really nice, kind of a purport within a purport. And Prabhupada says here, and I quote him, he says, "By serving the servant of God, one can please God more than by directly serving the Lord. The Lord is more pleased when he sees that his servants are properly respected, because such servants risk everything for the service of the Lord and are so dear to the Lord. By serving the servants of the Lord, one gradually gets the quality of such servants, and thus one becomes qualified to hear the glories of the Lord." So, he's making this very clear, the importance of serving the devotees. Not just the pure devotees, the devotees, the Vaishnavas, those who are engaged sincerely in the Lord's service. But if we can get the association of pure devotees, obviously that is the best. But the point is that Krishna is more pleased by us serving or attempting to serve the pure devotees than he is in those attempting to serve him directly. So that is actually our system. And the perfect example there is of Narada Muni. Because Narada Muni, from a material point of view, he was born as the son of a maidservant. Means assistant, many times removed from a queen. So not a very high birth by material estimation at all. But so he was born in his family. He's very simple, very young boy, uneducated. But during the Chaturmas, or the rainy season, as was the tradition. The Bhakti Vedantas, or the Vaishnavas, they came to his home. And the Bhakti Vedantas stayed there for the Chaturmas. Means for 3 months they stayed. 4 months they stayed continuously. And both Narada and his mother got the opportunity to render service to these great souls. They cooked for them, served them prasadam, washed their cloth, and did whatever other menial services they could do for them. At the same time, in the course of doing this, they became qualified to hear. So Narada, he started to absorb what the Bhakti Vedantas were speaking. And this purified his heart so much so that he became the liberated soul, Sri Narada Muni, just by the association of the Bhakti Vedantas. And it's said that at the time of his leaving this world, it was like thunder and lightning. You know, first we see the lightning bolt, and then a few moments later, we hear the thunderclap. So it was like that. He left his material body, and he immediately took on a spiritual body. So it was almost simultaneous. And then we know that he got the position of the transcendental spaceman, Sri Narada Muni, who's always playing his veena. Narada Muni Bhajana Veena. You know that? And he's simply chanting, playing his veena, and he's going everywhere around the universe. And there are so many pastimes with Sri Narada Muni. And he became this great saint. We always hear about him, we always refer to him. He's in so many pastimes. But his beginning was very humble. A maidservant's son. And by the power of the Bhakti Vedantas, he became this pure devotee. So, Prabhupada also mentions that such a devotee is very dear to Krishna. Actually, the most dear, which is mentioned in the 18th chapter in two verses, in 68 and 69. But one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed. And at the end, he will come back to me. There is no servant in this world more dear to me, nor will there ever be one more dear. So, how much Krishna appreciates the devotees who are trying to preach his message to others. That's how much he's appreciative. So really, there's no way of pleasing Krishna more and trying to give Krishna consciousness to another person. Very simple point. Now, in a lecture on this verse, Prabhupada also kind of extends this, because we heard earlier that by serving the pure devotees, we become empowered to hear, or qualified to actually hear. Because it's not that just anybody can come in the association of devotees and just hear and expect that they will get the full benefit. Anybody may get benefit, but it's not that everybody will get the full benefit. Because there has to be a qualification for that, to get the full benefit. So Rupa Goswami now, he gives a 10-step process for how to step-by-step advance in Krishna consciousness. He lays it out very clearly. This verse is found in the Nectar of Devotion, Adoshara, Tasaru, and so on. It's a long, long verse. It's there, it's quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada quotes it in the Bhagavad Gita. He often refers to this. But I have simplified everything. I've removed the Sanskrit and I just made it very simple. So the first step in the 10-step process is faith. And that is called Shraddha, of course. But that faith is very preliminary. It's very shallow. meanings that it's one, it's more like an initial attraction or curiosity that someone may have read or seen or heard something about Krishna consciousness. Maybe they saw a Harinam party, or they heard the holy name being chanted. Maybe they got one of Prabhupada's books. Maybe they got prasadam. Maybe they came in contact with a devotee. Something. It kind of sparks the initial step. Because beneath it all, everyone's a devotee. But the covering has to be removed enough so that the spark is ignited. And the system for again becoming rehabilitated and to remove all the unwanted things, it starts with that. Just a little bit of faith. That little faith, it brings one in the association of devotees. Now, Prabhupada, very interesting point that Prabhupada makes is that he says that even if a person simply has appreciation for devotees, or appreciation for the Krishna consciousness movement in any way, shape, or form, then that person gets immeasurable benefit. Just by appreciation, the person says, oh, that devotee is nice, that person is nice, or, you know, what they're doing is a good thing, a nice thing, they're good people, or, you know, they're trying to help other people, whatever. They have some appreciation. They're giving out food to people. They're whatever. Just that appreciation, Prabhupada said, is such a major step towards advancement. Therefore, what do we do? Or rather, what should we do? We should strive to increase the distribution of Prabhupada's books, Harinam, Prasadam, or any other programs that package these things. University programs, however, whatever outreach things we may do. A nice temple atmosphere. That's actually our duty as followers of Lord Chaitanya. Because if we, to call ourselves a true follower of Mahaprabhu, we have to be in the mood of assisting Mahaprabhu. And how do you assist Mahaprabhu? You assist him by trying to distribute what he has come to distribute, which is love of God. So each of us in our own ways has to strive to give Krishna consciousness to other persons. So that's our duty. We have to make the environment very nice so that when people come, that they feel that this is something special. Not that they experience something negative. They should have a very positive experience so that this helps to foster their development in Krishna consciousness. So that's the first step, faith. The second is association with devotees. If someone... it has that initial inclination or desire that will bring him into association with devotees to learn from them, to observe them. Like so many people, oftentimes we say, you know, is there a new person here today? And we ask them, what has brought you? And they say, I am an observer. I've come to observe. Which is good. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But they should come to learn. But if we are not good devotees, and if we are not good examples, then what is it that they will see? They'll see, on one hand, a perfect philosophy, which is flawless. We'll challenge anybody to find a flaw with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. It does not have one. It's perfect. But perfect philosophy on one hand, on the other hand, we have practitioners who don't measure up to what the philosophy says. They may not be very strict in their practices. They may have so many material desires, or they may have so many bad habits that are deeply ingrained within them. And it may appear that they're even worse than non-devotees at times. 37 years has taught me that. Sometimes neophyte devotees can act much worse than the non-devotees. Sometimes you'll find that the non-devotees are more polite, They're kinder, they're more honorable, they have more integrity than sometimes the devotees, the struggling sadhus. Well, that's not what we want to show people when they come into our association. Because they've ignited a spark, and now they've come this far. They've come into the association of devotees. And that can all be finished if we are not ourselves good examples. Because they're going to look and they're going to examine. They're going to see, do these people match up to the philosophy? Are they exemplifying the philosophy or not? Or are they just like ordinary people? Or even worse than ordinary people? So we have a very great responsibility to become examples. Everybody, whoever you are, and whatever level of advancement you have, you have a duty to be a good example. So when persons come, they have a positive experience, and they are charmed, and they are benefited, and they can continue. They feel inspired in such association. It should be such a spiritually vibrant atmosphere that people feel inspired. They want to go forward. And yes, this is what I've been looking for. This is wonderful. These people are something out of this world. Something good out of this world. And I want to associate with them. And I can see the benefits. So, we see that Prabhupada attracted so many people just on based on his purity. One person attracted so many just by the way that he dealt with people, the way that he practiced his sadhana, the way that he was a perfect example, attracted so many devotees. We can't imitate that. We can't imitate the Shaktivesha avatar. But we can follow in his footsteps. That's what we're taught. Inakata, I can't remember exactly. Follow in the footsteps of Mahatmas. That's our duty, our method. We follow in their footsteps, meaning that we follow their instructions. The things that they have taught us, we try to do that. Prabhupada told us what? Chant so many, he told us to chant 16 rounds. He told us to follow the four regular principles. He told us to study his books and so many other instructions that he gave us. So we should follow in his footsteps, and if we do what he told us to do, then we will become gradually pure devotees. Even though it may seem so far away from us now, the platform of pure devotional service, the fact is, if you really follow the process, the way the Prabhupada has given it, you will gradually rise above all the impurities and all the attachments, and you will become a pure devotee of Krishna. So that is what we're striving for. So we should always be, you know, of good character. And as Prabhupada said, when they meet one of my devotees, they should say, that person is a perfect gentleman. Or a perfect gentle woman. Third step is taking initiation. And this means to find a spiritual master, guru. This is also in the association of devotees, we hear from many. And we know that there's both the Diksha Guru, the one who actually gives the name, and there are the Shiksha Gurus, who are giving instruction. And they work together. So when one associates with devotees, he may hear from so many different devotees. And he may accept one or more of those as Shiksha Gurus. And eventually, amongst those, he may select one as a Diksha Guru. But the main way, or the main process for selecting and accepting guru is by hearing. You don't select by seeing. It's not that, you know, I remember someone once said that the guru walks in a certain way, or the guru tilts his head in a certain way, or the guru, whatever, raises his eyebrows in a certain way, or something. It's not, it doesn't have to do with the externals. It has to do with what the person says. Is he repeating the message of Krishna? Is he repeating the message of his spiritual master? That's what makes him a guru. Otherwise, as Prabhupada says, he's a garu. You know what garu means? Cow. Cow. There's garu and there's guru. So if you don't repeat Krishna's message, you'll be a garu and not a guru. Better late than never, folks. Thank you. So we develop faith by hearing. This is our method. And I have a really powerful experience of this when before I actually met Prabhupada. About 2 years before, I had gotten Bhagavad Gita, and then I started to correspond with a devotee, because I was living quite far away from any temple this time. And those were the early days when there weren't many temples. And I started to correspond with a devotee in Los Angeles. And he started to send me things. He sent me japa beads. He sent me books. He sent me Back to Godhead. He sent me... what else did he send me? Well, the main thing is he sent me, at that time, tapes, which are not obsolete. He said, sent me recorded lectures of Prabhupada. And I remember that when I was listening to those recorded lectures of Prabhupada, that it was very profound, very profound experience. It was life-changing. Just hearing Prabhupada's voice, and was so powerful, that medium of sound. Again, I had never seen him, never met him yet, but just by hearing from him through the tapes, I was very attracted, and I felt very impelled to go forward in the practice of Krishna consciousness, because Prabhupada was so powerful and the message of Krishna was coming through so clearly. So that was a real changing point in my devotional life when I started to hear like that. So hearing is so important, and that's really spoken about in this verse in purport. So, we select a guru amongst many shiksha gurus. One is a diksha guru. He gives us the name. He is the giving us a name through the sipic succession as it's coming down from Krishna, from guru to disciple. So this is the point in which we become very regulated. We should become, actually, before this point, before initiation. But certainly, at this point, we should be very regulated in devotional service. We should be very sincere practitioners. And we should know that Krishna in our hearts, as a super soul, knows our innermost feelings and thoughts. We can't hide from Krishna. But sometimes devotees have this idea, this very strange notion, that they can hide their nonsense activities from Krishna. You may be able to hide from others, other devotees and other people. You may be doing things in private or in another room. You may think nobody's seeing it, nobody's hearing it, nobody knows. But Krishna knows. Because he's in your heart. And he knows everything. He knows you better than you know yourself. He knows every desire that you have within your heart. Even those you're not even aware of yet. Because some of them are still lying dormant as a seed from previous lives. He knows them. So, all said, you can't fool Krishna. You can't fake it. He's very much aware of what's going on. So we have to take the order, as Prabhupada said, of the spiritual master as our life and soul. That means the most important thing in our lives, in our whole existence, is to follow the order of the spiritual master. And Prabhupada, again, has set the example, the standard for this, with following the order of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. Look what Prabhupada did. He was in household life. He had many children. He had a business. He had so much responsibility. But yet, when he got in contact with Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, almost from the first meeting, we know that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati looked to him and said, he and his friend who had gone that first time, and heard Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati singled them out, looked at them and said, you are educated young men, you are English speaking, so you should spread the message of Mahaprabhu in foreign lands. So he gave this instruction. And of course, immediately Prabhupada was kind of taken back, he said, initially. But later you realize that this was his eternal spiritual master, and this was an eternal order, and he nurtured that order throughout his life. One thing about instructions is that we can't always immediately fulfill them. There may be something that's preventing us from doing that. It may be the time, maybe the place, maybe the circumstance, something preventing us from immediately fulfilling that order. So Prabhupada kept the order in his heart. And he was working and doing. He was trying to preach in India, trying to establish Krishna consciousness, trying to start this center, that center, doing so many things. But if you look at it from one point of view, there wasn't a lot of success. Not many people coming, and not a lot happening. So Prabhupada, when he was at Radha Damodar living, and he had taken sannyas, and he was living in the Radha Damodar temple, he said that one day, he had, because in his kitchen, he used to cook for himself, in the kitchen there, small kitchen, there was a lattice worked window, so he could see through that window to the samadhi of Srila Rupa Goswami, which is just in back of the Radha Damodar temple. And so, as he was looking at this samadhi, and meditating upon Srila Rupa Goswami, he got this tremendous inspiration in his heart that now is the time. I should fulfill the order of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and I should go and preach in the Western countries. Look, he was already retired. He was already 69 years old. This is a time when persons usually slow down and they go into retirement and, you know, they, you know, whatever. The non-devotees relax and they do all kinds of things. But even older persons, they just take the time to now hear and chant in a holy place and live their last days like that. Not for Prabhupada. He thought, I should do this. He felt that inspiration from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati that now I should go and I should spread the message from Mahaprabhu in the Western countries. So he made his plan. He went to Bombay. He got sponsorship on a Jaladuta, a freighter ship. He went across the sea, you know, for weeks. He suffered two heart attacks. He thought if a third one would come, he would die. But somehow or another, at that time, Srimati Radharani came. Supposedly, he had this vision. Srimati Radharani came in a boat and said, don't worry. The rest of the journey will be very smooth. It will be very smooth for you. And from that point on, the waters became very smooth, and Prabhupada's journey was you know, eventless. It was really pleasant. So, you know, he was so fixed on the order. In the Nectar of Instruction, it is said, there's a word there, utsaha. Utsaha means enthusiasm. And Prabhupada gives a definition for enthusiasm. Because what does it mean to be enthusiastic in Krishna consciousness? Just to say, Harivo! Harivo! Anybody can do that. Even a child can do that. Anybody can do that. You can practically train a dog to do that. That's not a big thing. Although it's be an advanced dog if he could Shanghai roll. But anyway, Utsaha, Prabhupada said, enthusiasm in Krishna consciousness means that we should execute our activities with intelligence. It means that we are given the order, and then we execute that order with intelligence, enthusiastically. That's the definition. To execute with enthusiastic intelligence. We have to use our brains, our God-given intelligence, to figure out how to carry out that order. Look, Prabhupada, it took him so long how to do it. He couldn't do it until 69. The time wasn't right. The situation wasn't right. He had family, so many things. So he waited. He kept that desire in his heart. And finally, when the time came, he went, even though he was 69 years old. So each of us, we also, as we receive the order from Guru, we have to figure out how we're going to make it happen. We shouldn't be dull-headed. Devotees, Prabhupada said, should be intelligent. They should figure out how to get something accomplished. We shouldn't think, oh, so-and-so das, or so-and-so dasi. They're the leaders. They can take all the responsibility. They can do all the thinking for me. I'll just take prasadam. Sounds like a great program. Except that that's not using your intelligence with enthusiasm. So you should learn how to do that. There is a commentary on a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, 241. Very famous verse. This is the verse that Prabhupada, as he was studying this verse in the 50s, he was so inspired by Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's commentary on this verse that he said this was the single most reason that he took up the order of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. I want to read you what Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur he says on this verse. And later you can look up this verse yourself. It's very famous. But he says, the best kind of intelligence I can have is intelligence used in service of Krishna. Intelligence is defined as fixed when it is intent upon following my spiritual master's instructions, such as chanting the name of Krishna, remembering his activities, and performing service to his lotus feet. My spiritual master's instructions are my sadhana and my life, both in the beginning stages of bhakti, as well as in bhakti's perfectional stage. I desire only to follow his instructions. I accept nothing else as my life's work, even in dreams. Whether I am happy or distressed, whether the material world remains or is destroyed, I don't care. There is no loss for me. I simply must carry the orders of my spiritual master. Fixedness upon his order is determined intelligence and devotional service, and only by being fixed on his orders can such determined intelligence prosper. So when Prabhupada heard that commentary, read that commentary, he was so inspired. And that pushed him forward to eventually make the plans to go to the West and preach. Moving on to the fourth stage. The fourth stage is getting free from unwanted habits, or the anartas. We have so many anartas that we're carrying in our hearts from previous lifetimes. Because as we discussed last week, we have been here for a long time. We don't know how long. Perhaps thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of lifetimes we've been in the material world. And we probably spanned all the different species of life. And somehow we've come to this human form of life. But we have come with a lot of baggage. A lot of baggage we're carrying. A lot of reactions to the past sinful activities we performed in the past lifetimes. So many desires are there in the heart. The Nectar of Devotion said that there are many stages of development. Some were experiencing, some were about to experience, some are still in the form of a seed, they've yet to sprout, but they may sprout, and they will sprout in the future if we don't learn how to remove them from the cores of our hearts. So, if we're practicing our Bhajana Kriya, meaning after we're initiated and we're sincerely chanting and doing all the things that we're supposed to do following the order of the Guru, then we should be removing these things, these material desires, and the results of past activities from the cores of our hearts. So this is kind of like a barometer for seeing how we're advancing in Krishna consciousness. If we are truly introspective and we look within, well, we should be honest with ourselves and see how many material desires are still lingering within my heart. How many desires do I actually have that are separate from the interest of Krishna? And that gives us a gauge to see how we're doing. Because if we're really practicing in the right way, our material desires should be reducing. We should be reducing the material desires. We should less and less have the desire to do things separate from Krishna's interest. So this is a way that we can see, honestly, just where we stand. Artificial restraint is a temporary thing. You can't artificially restrain yourself from the desires that the senses have. You can do that only for so long. That's why we know that in other spiritual disciplines, they are in some ways even stricter than we are in some of the things that they practice. But we often see that they have difficulty maintaining it because they don't get param drisvanavartita. They don't get a higher taste. Because they don't get the higher taste, they have nothing else to grab onto, so they are forced to accept the lower taste, and they fall. We find an example, a devotee, I won't mention the name, but it's someone we all know, that before he actually met Prabhupada, he was trying to be renounced, and he was trying to be a spiritual person. This was in the 60s, in the midst of the counterculture, where people were looking for some alternative to the mainstream material life. So he was a spiritual seeker. He was actually living in the forest. He was actually living in a treehouse. And he was eating just some berries and whatever he could find, like this, eating very simply. And he was maintaining this for quite some time, actually. But he still had this burning desire within his heart, because his particular attachment was for ice cream. And living in that treehouse in the middle of the forest, of course, there was no Baskin and Robbins or Magnolia or whatever other types of ice creams they have here. He couldn't get that. So one day, he was just overwhelmed by the desire. And he jumped out of that treehouse and he ran down to the city and he went to the nearest ice cream shop that he could find and he ordered just tubs of ice cream. And he just ate and ate and ate and ate. So practically he got sick because that desire was so there, close in the heart. So you can't artificially do these things. You have to experience a higher taste. Otherwise, it won't last. So, sincere practice will remove this seed of desire, which is pushing us to act. Because there has to be a seed. Everything that we're doing, separate from Krishna, has a seed, has a root. The seed is the root. The roots grow, and then we're pushed to action. So, if we're practicing Krishna consciousness in the right way, we're really sincere and really prayerful and doing everything that we're supposed to be doing, we should be frying the seed. Because you know, if you fry the seed, if you heat the seed to a certain temperature, it destroys it. It can't germinate. You know this? It's a fact. If you heat a seed to a high enough temperature, it kills it. It cannot germinate. So that is what we want to do with the seeds of desire that we have in our hearts. We want to fry them. We want to burn them to a crisp, so they become like ash. That should be our goal. So if we're burning them with the fire of Krishna consciousness, then we can remove them forever. And if we do that, then this will lead us to the fifth stage, which is steadiness. Steadiness means that one is very fixed in following the orders of Guru and Krishna. He's steady as a rock. He's just very, very steady. Srila Rupa Goswami says there's three keys: determination, patience, and enthusiasm. So he's pushing forward with all three of these. And nothing can shake his steadiness. It's not that sometimes he's on and sometimes he's off. The neophyte devotees are like this. That sometimes they're in the fire and sometimes they're in what? What's the opposite of fire? Ice? Coldness. Refrigerator. I don't know. But sometimes they're cold and sometimes they're hot. We want to be hot, not in terms of passion, but we want to be hot in terms of our practice. We want to be on fire. Not, we don't want to be ice cubes, ice men. We want to be firemen. Firemen. They must have some fictional superhero like that, right? Fire person or something like that? Huh? Fire what?
X-Men.
X-Men? Yeah, right. It's fire, right? So he was made of fire, or he could use fire or something like that. Anyway, we want to be like that, not the ice person. So we don't want to be sometimes on and sometimes off. That means not very advanced. If you're like that, chapala, flickering back and forth, it means you have not removed those desires from your heart, and they're still pulling you down. So we're steady. It leads us to the sixth stage, which is firm faith. You remember in the beginning I said there's shraddha, there's initial faith, attraction, curiosity, a desire to learn more, come in association with devotees. Now at this stage, firm faith is something much different. It's something very real. It's firm. It's deep. It is something lasting. It's something which is present all the time. The faith is so strong, you can never be shaken. And then, in the seventh stage, there's taste, or ruchi. That means we remove the material desires. And now, we are actually coming in contact directly with the soul. And we are beginning to get a taste now. A genuine taste. It means that we get great pleasure from hearing and chanting. Just like you see in the end pages of Bhagavatam. You know, you see Srila Sukadeva Goswami speaking to Maharaj Pariksit. These questions and answers, they form the Bhagavatam. You know, 16,000 some hundred odd verses. But you see in attendance, many sages are there. You see Vyasadeva there. You see many great personalities in their audience. They're already self-realized souls. Why do they need to hear from another self-realized soul, Sukadeva Goswami? Why? Because they have taste. They relish this. They never grow tired. They want to hear more and more. They want to chant more and more. Like Rupa Goswami said, Prabhupada quoted him, that even if I have millions of tongues and trillions of ears, it would not be enough to relish the process of hearing enchantment, because my desire is unlimited. So one will, at this stage, will spontaneously chant all the time. One will not struggle to merely chant 16 rounds. We may be at the position now where we're thinking, gosh, how can I finish even 16 rounds? Some may be thinking, how can I finish one round? Maybe we may be struggling, it may be difficult for us to finish 16 rounds. So at this point, we are chanting with such taste that it is effortless, that we want it, just we chant all the time. And you see Prabhupada's example? You see him on the videos and things, you watch. If Prabhupada's not speaking, he's got his hand in his bead bag and he's chanting. There's not a time when he's just sitting idly and, you know, sitting back and resting or something. You don't see that. You see he's always engaged, hearing and chanting constantly. Even when Prabhupada was sleeping, we saw that, and you can't really call it sleep with a devotee like that, that he would often be saying something, preaching, or making some philosophical point, or giving some pastime, and then he would doze off in the late evening because he would rest for an hour or something. And then when he awoke, he would repeat, or he would continue exactly from where he left off. Complete continuity. That little period of rest didn't do anything in terms of dulling him. But we know that sleep is ignorance, isn't it? If you go into deep sleep and you wake up, usually it's difficult to shake off the ignorance, isn't it? You're like, you know, where am I? What's going on here? Who? You know, or someone wakes us up abruptly, you know, we don't know what's going on, right? Because we're so deep in ignorance. It takes us time to, like, clear our heads and understand what's going on, where we're at, like this. But not so with Prabhupada. Prabhupada was just was continuity. So at this point, we have this continuity, and we're always chanting. If we're not chanting externally, we're chanting within the mind. Chanting is something that goes on continuously. And there's something, an interesting point that Prabhupada made to John Lennon around 1969 when he met with John Lennon, he met with George Harrison, Yoko Ono, three of them. And at that time, John Lennon asked Prabhupada, he said, how can you find a true spiritual master? How can you know if someone is genuine? John Lennon was philosophizing, and he was kind of saying, he said, isn't it a bit like flowers? I mean, there's flowers, they're all flowers, so how do you know? They're all flowers. I mean, in other words, he was saying, they're all gurus, so how do you know who is genuine and who is not? So Prabhupada, of course, used the same analogy he had given about flowers, and Prabhupada told him that, yes, there are many types of flowers, but amongst those flowers, some are fragrant and some have no fragrance at all. And amongst the ones that are fragrant, some are very special fragrances, like gardenias and so on. They have a very special fragrance. So amongst all the flowers, one is particularly special. So he gave this analogy, and he said that you can find the genuine guru, or you can tell who is a genuine guru, by finding someone who is addicted to hearing and chanting about Krishna. The person who is most addicted to hearing and chanting about Krishna is the true guru. And we see that by Prabhupada's example. He was addicted to hearing and chanting about Krishna. So, taste. If we can get that taste, it will make it much easier for us. It will not be a struggle. It will be very relishable. We'll be attracted, instead of having to push ourselves to do it, we'll be attracted to Krishna. We'll be attracted to His holy name. And we'll be pulled like a magnet. We'll be pulled towards Krishna. The eighth step is attachment. After we gain taste, then our attachment to Krishna, it grows very deep. One is deeply attached to Krishna. One Prabhupada says that one desires to see Krishna always in the form of the deity, the holy name, or within his heart. His attachment is so strong. An example here of Srila Prabhupada, and he was lecturing about the pastimes of Ajamil, the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada was talking about how Ajamil had fallen to a very low status due to bad association. Even though he was born in a Brahmin family, he had fallen to a very low status. He had married a prostitute, he had many children, and he was very fallen. But he named his youngest child Narayan. So when he was on his deathbed, he was calling out, "Narayan! Narayan! Narayan!" He actually wasn't calling out for Krishna. He was calling out for his child. But the fact that he was calling out for Narayan means that he was chanting Namabhas. It means chanting without offense. He was just calling out the name of Narayan. So as Prabhupada was retelling the story, and Prabhupada was calling out, "Narayan! Narayan! Narayan!" And all of a sudden, Prabhupada stopped. And he lost external consciousness. And he went into some form of samadhi. He could not speak. And he was definitely with Narayan. Because as he was calling, "Narayan, Narayan, Narayan," Krishna must have come. Because Prabhupada was just stunned, closed his eyes. He was in internal consciousness. And a few moments later, devotees didn't know what to do, what to say, what to think. Some were chanting, they were waiting. It was so quiet that a pin could drop. Then a few moments later, Prabhupada came to external consciousness and said, "Just chant Hare Krishna." So, the attachment is so great that one can be like this, stunned in ecstasy. Ninth stage is bhava. Bhava means emotion. But in this case, it means spiritual emotions. This is the preliminary stage of love of God. In this stage, one experiences bodily transformations. But Nectar Devotion says, the hairs stand on end. There's so many things that one could have. So many bodily transformations. And the love is very intense. Very intense at that point. But then at prema, in the 10th stage, this is a summons of love for Krishna. And in this stage, one actually becomes mad. Mad for Krishna. As we see in the example of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya, in the last years of his life, his close associates, they saw that he was acting in very extreme ways. Sometimes just running madly with his arms upraised and crying out for Krishna and running towards the sea thinking that it was the Jamuna, or running towards a sand dune in Puri and thinking that it was Govardhan Hill, or seeing a devotee and wanting to embrace him, or seeing a tamal tree and thinking it was a Krishna and running and embracing. And sometimes he would injure his physical, so-called physical body. He would bruise it, he would cut it, blood would ooze. Sometimes he would, in his separation, feeling his separation from Krishna, he would rub his limbs or his face against the walls and they would bleed. So his devotees wanted to protect him. So at night, in Puri, they put him in what was called the Gambira. The Gambira was a small little structure, a little house. And they locked him inside. His servant, Govinda, locked Lord Chaitanya inside. He bolted the door from outside. So there's no way that Lord Chaitanya could have gotten out. But somehow or other, every night, Lord Chaitanya got out. The door opened, he got out, and he madly was running, calling, crying for Krishna. And sometimes they found Lord Chaitanya in very strange situations. One time, the associates of Lord Chaitanya saw this fisherman who was running up and down the beach of Puri, and he was just calling out like a crazy man. And you know, and they said, "What's wrong with you?" And he said, "I don't know. When I was fishing, all of a sudden I scooped up this human being, and this human being was calling out the name of Krishna. And when I saw him, then somehow I was transformed." So they realized that it was Mahaprabhu, who had lost consciousness and fainted in ecstasy, and this fisherman had picked him up. And the fisherman had come in contact with Mahaprabhu, and he had become spiritually enlivened, transformed. And they went to see Mahaprabhu and they revived him. So oftentimes he would faint in ecstasy. One time they found him in a very strange situation, that he had gone amongst the cows, and he had pulled his arms and his legs inside the torso of his body. So the only thing that was there was the torso of his body. Arms and legs had gone inside. So they wondered, well, what to do? So of course the devotees, I think Nityananda Prabhu said that we should chant. Just chant. So as soon as they chanted loudly, "Haribo!" What happened? Lord Chaitanya's hands and arms and legs popped out! And he also said, "Haribo!" Sometimes Lord Chaitanya's joints would elongate, and only the skin would hold the bones together. The joints would actually come apart. The bones would separate. And the only thing that would hold together the skin like that. Sometimes blood would ooze from his pores. Tears would shoot out from his eyes like a syringe. He would dance and he would shoot out tears and wet the bodies of his devotees in kirtan like this. So one who is experiencing prema, may experience so many different things. But this is for us to yet experience. We can hear about it from the example of great devotees. We can hear about it from Mahaprabhu's pastimes. We can begin to imagine what it might be like. But until we actually experience it, we'll never really understand it. So, all said, that the sincere practitioner of Krishna consciousness has the highest thing to look for. Because Krishna consciousness is the highest philosophy, it's the highest spiritual practice. We all have to assign this goal of becoming pure devotees in Krishna consciousness. And by the mercy of the Vaishnavas, Guru, and Krishna, we can become, we can achieve this position of becoming pure devotees in this very lifetime. Srila Prabhupada promised us that if we simply followed what he told us to do, that we could become pure devotees in this lifetime, and we could go back home, back to Godhead. So that's Prabhupada's promise. All we have to do is do what he said. So I'll leave you with those thoughts, and I'll ask if anyone has any questions relating to this verse or to what I have said. Any questions? Yes.
Guru Maharaj, I'd like to ask about this battle between impersonalists
and
disciples. Clashes. When did it start? Did it start during the time of Maharaj Padmashit, or did it start during his say Leviticus 1964, did it start with the working groups, higher bodies, and the personalities have different kinds of interpretations from the
Okay.
Where did it start?
That's your question. I understand. Question is, when did this battle between the Maya bodies and the Vaishnavas, the personalists, the impersonalists and the personalists, when did this start? The thing is that the material world goes through different phases. There's four yugas. The Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwarpa Yuga, and Kali Yuga. And we know that in Satya Yuga, basically 100% of the people are Krishna conscious, or they're God conscious. But then, with the next yuga, it decreases to 75%. So I think it's quite safe to say that probably even as early as the beginning of the Treta Yuga, there are already that kind of duality there, personalist and impersonalist, was there. So, a long, long time ago. Another question? Question, yes, sir.
One more.
Another question?
Last night I overheard the TV that the U.S., this is a wrestling between, and a lot of Christians are wrestling. The U.S., between the U.S. and the Russia, and this was done outside the Central Park. And the loser, the Russian wrestler, when he was interviewed, said that it was due because of the neon lights. He was just disturbed, that's why the U.S. Won. I'd like to know about the great match between Krishna and Kanura and Balarama and Mustika. Can you tell the battle between them in the courtyard? Is it a mismatch? Is wrestling? Please tell us.
Well, you have some interesting questions there. Question is, apparently there was some wrestling match between some Russian wrestler and American wrestler. And the Russian wrestler lost.
Yes.
He lost, and he blamed the neon lights for the reason. Anyway, I guess everybody can come up with some excuse. And Krishna, of course, he went to see Kamsa, and then he and Balaram were paired with Musaka and another wrestler. But it seemed, in terms of material estimations, that those wrestlers were many times larger than Krishna and Balaram. And Krishna and Balaram looked like little kids compared to these huge, big, muscular wrestlers. So, from a material point of view, it definitely looked like a mismatch. Right? I mean, just like, let's say, we have a match between Money Pacquiao and Shane Mosley. Now, of course, they're more evenly matched, right? They're in the same weight class, they're similar in height, so on and so forth. What if Money Pacquiao, with his size and weight, had to face someone who was 6'6 and weighed 285 pounds, you know, and was like solid rock muscle and was really a good fighter? What would be the chances of even Money Pacquiao winning that boxing match? Probably very slim, right? He would probably get pulverized to, you know, flattened, you know, to a pulp in about 2 seconds, right? This guy would just like boink, and that would be the end of him, right? So according to that, these two wrestlers, they should have easily defeated Krishna and Balaram. There's only one big difference, is that Krishna and Balaram just happen to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And therefore, they had all energies at their command. We know one of the energies, what is Krishna? All power, he has all strength. He's the strongest, right? So, Yeah, even though these wrestlers are so strong, Krishna and Balaram threw them around like they were like, you know, pieces of styrofoam. And he just threw them around, tossed them out. It was effortless because that's Krishna. He has unlimited strength. It's not based on material body at all. His body is totally spiritual. Balaram's body is totally spiritual. So it's full of Satchitananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. They have full strength. Easy. Okay, next question.
You have mentioned something from the Prabhupada here about that the reason we are coming here is due to our mistake of choice. And it's also said in the scripture that the jiva, due to his being part and parcel of Krishna, he also has the same quality that Krishna has. And then Krishna is being described as the infallible one, he who never commit mistakes. So my question is, if we have the same quality as Krishna, then why do we commit mistakes? I mean, why didn't he create us in such a way that we will not commit mistakes, so we will not fall down?
This is the $64 million question that everyone asks. We've heard it many times. Why is it? How is it possible? Krishna's perfect. He doesn't make mistakes. He's infallible. And we're supposed to be in the parts and parcels. We should have the same qualities of Krishna. So how is it that we could make a mistake and leave the spiritual world? Because I said it was a misuse of our independence. Well, first of all, we're not Krishna. We're the part and parcel of Krishna, which means that we have a measure of his qualities. We don't have them all. The jiva only has a certain percentage he can have. The jiva can only have up to 78% of the qualities of Krishna. But the quantity of those qualities is very minute. Krishna's qualities are unlimited. So we're like a spark that shoots out of the fire. Yes, we have the same qualities of heat and light, but we're very tiny. And just like a spark can be easily extinguished when it shoots out of the fire, we as the jiva souls can also become covered by Maya. Because we're left with independence. Krishna does not force us. We're created in that way. That he gives us, he always gives us the choice whether to go towards him or go towards material energy. He creates us in that way. We have that free will. Otherwise, you really can't say that you can love Krishna. Because to love a person, it has to be voluntary. One person cannot force another person to love him or her. It has to be voluntary. So Krishna does not force. He wants the jiva soul to make the choice himself to serve him. And if the jiva soul chooses not to serve him, then he creates a situation here for such souls, as mentioned in this verse, those who revolt against, those who are rebellious against, those who turn their backs to Krishna. He makes an arrangement for them in the material world. But even this is a good arrangement. Because gradually, the souls become rehabilitated and they realize that this isn't where they should be. And that if they continue on in this way, they'll simply suffer more and more and more and more. As I mentioned, they'll slide down to demoniac species of life. So, it's due to free will. He gives us that measure of free will. He's the supreme. We're his servants. That's eternally the position. We can make mistakes. He cannot. That's the difference between God and the individual soul. We can still make a mistake. We can still misuse our independence. Okay? That's the way it works. Any other questions?
Guru Maharaj, is there any difference between a Vipra and a Brahmana?
Between
a Vipra and a Brahmana?
A Vipra and a Brahmana. Vipra is basically another term. It's kind of a similar term as a Brahmana. Similar qualities. I don't know if there's any real difference that I'm aware of. Maybe a Vipra is more specialized in a particular area of Vedic knowledge, but really not so much different, as far as I know. Any other questions? Matajis, any questions? Still awake over there? Any questions?
Maharaj.
You're Mataji. Is there something we don't know?
I'd like to ask a question.
Okay.
We all know that Kali Yuga is very hard to... We're struggling, although it's a sweet struggle in our spiritual life, but we're constantly struggling. And sometimes we become very weak. We have seen in our personal experiences, we become very weak, and what happens is when we become weak, the tendency is to get away from the association of devotees because we do not want other devotees to see our weakness. But in the course of time, when we become more weak, then the taste diminishes even more. Then the danger comes whether we still want to become devotees or not. So my question is, what is a practical way that we can avoid that? That before it comes to that point, that we begin to lose taste, or out of embarrassment of our weakness, that we do not want to let devotees know what's really happening to our lives. Before it comes to that point, what do we do? You cry for help. Because if you cry for help, then it's also a sign of weakness. So what do we do? The most practical thing.
Now, the thing is, for a materialist, the cry for help is a sign of weakness. To say that we need help from somebody else is a sign that we're weak in some way. So that's often a reason that people don't reach out for help. But a devotee understands that his only chance for survival in Krishna consciousness is to keep association with devotees. There's no other way. You have to keep association with devotees. Otherwise, you will not be able to maintain your practices, and you will become weaker and weaker. Probably gave the example, right? One straw can, a stick can easily broken, but a bundle of sticks, very difficult. So if you keep association with devotees, you are less likely to have difficulties, and you can remain strong, and you can rely on the strengths of others. So one must, at all costs, keep association with devotees. And one may say, oh, I got my job, I got my family, I got this and I got that, I got no time for devotees. Well, everyone has a cell phone, right? Just get a plan where you have unlimited calls, and you can call the devotees, call on the phone, get on the internet, just don't get on any Ritvik sites, and you can communicate that way. There's so many ways. You know, like before we mentioned, enthusiasm with intelligence. So we have to be intelligent how to get association, how to maintain good association. Keep good association by reading Prabhupada's books, associating with Prabhupada, listening to Prabhupada, listening to devotees of Prabhupada. There's many ways to keep association. If we're, you know, it's just like, you know, a real businessman, he's a real opportunist. He always knows how to take the opportunity to make money. He can turn, as Prabhupada said, a real businessman can turn sand into gold. He's an opportunist. He sees what to do at just the right time. Just how to do, how to invest, or how to do whatever. So a devotee should be like that, but for Krishna. He should be a spiritual opportunist. And he should just tax his brain to figure out how he can maintain good association and continue the flow of his advancement in Krishna consciousness. Yeah, it takes some effort. That's why Rupa Goswami says determination, patience, and enthusiasm are required. Yes, we have to be a bit determined. You know, we're purchasing here the most valuable gem. So it's priceless. So we have to put forward some effort. We have to be determined, you know, to get it. Although it's said we take a step towards Krishna and take 100 steps towards us, but at least we have to take that step. So there has to be continuity. You have to keep taking the steps. But key is to keep the association of devotees at all costs. At all costs. And you know, you cannot keep the association of devotees if you are a Kanishtha Adhikari, and if you are in the mood of a Kanishtha Adhikari who has the quality of fault-finding and seeing all the, you know, dark spots in the character of devotees. Prabhupada said, if they want to find faults, they can find faults with me too. Because if someone's a real true fault finder, they'll find a fault. Because that's all they're looking for. It's like a fly. The fly seeks out the dirty thing. But the bee only seeks out the nectar. So devotees are supposed to be like bees. And they're supposed to seek out the nectar. They seek out the good. See the good. Because that's what Krishna does. Krishna sees the good in the devotees. He doesn't see the bad. At the end of the day, he doesn't see the bad. He sees the good. But he never forgets, he says. He never forgets the service of the devotee. He doesn't forget that. So, we have to make that effort and to keep the association. And again, after so many years, we shouldn't find ourselves in the position of Kanishtha Adhikaris, where we're still in this mood. Oh, the devotees are like this. The devotees are like that. She said this. He did that. Yes, you can absorb yourself in that consciousness if you want to. But if you can rise a little bit above that, then you may look around and you might find some good qualities in the devotees. Prabhupada said, devotees are like, they're like, one example he gave is like someone like who's in a shower. So they may not be clean when they start the shower. So just as you're going into the shower, somebody says, oh, look how dirty you are. You're so filthy. But the person's going in the shower, he's taking the process to become clean. Soon he will be clean because he washes with soap and he gets clean and he'll get out of the shower. If you point your finger in the beginning when he's dirty, you can say he's dirty, but he's in the process of getting cleaned. So it's easy for the neophyte to point and say, oh, these devotees, he's not very advanced, he's got this bad quality and that bad quality, and he did this 20 years ago, I remember that. 20 years ago he did this, 10 years ago he did that. And if you maintain that fly-like mentality, you'll simply remain as a Kanishtha Adhikari. You'll go in this vicious cycle. You just stay. Just like, you know, the hamster on the the treadmill, just going round and round and round and round, not getting anywhere. So, you know, we should rise above that already. How many years have we been devotees? 5, 10, 15, 20, 30? How long is it going to take? Is it going to be lifetimes for us before we wake up and realize that we need the association of the Vaishnavas to advance in Krishna consciousness? We have to keep that association at all costs. How many lifetimes are we going to spend on that before we wake up? It's so rare we've come to the human form of life after so long. Are we going to really risk falling down again to another species? Because Vaishnava aparadha is a serious thing. It's a hatimata, it's a mad elephant offense. It means that you may lose your Krishna consciousness for lifetimes. So, all said, we can't remain as kanishtas. We have to advance. And then, if you advance a little bit, you will seek out and you will relish the association of the Vaishnavas at all costs. There won't be any excuse that will keep you from seeing and keeping association with devotees. Actually, there's no excuse. The bottom line is that there's no excuse. You may think you have some good reasons, but ultimately, none of them really hold any water at the end of the day. It's our choice. It's just like it's our free will. It's our choice. If we want to associate with devotees, we can. That's the issue here. What's our priority? Do we want to associate or do we not? If we want to, we will find the way. What's the saying? With the will, there's a way. If your will is strong enough, you'll always find a way how to associate with devotees. So that's all we hear from Prabhupada, from Bhakti No Thakur, from Narottam Das Thakur, and their bhajans, and so on and so forth. They're talking about the association of devotees. Not that they're just practicing Krishna consciousness on their own. It's not like that. They're relishing the association of the Vaishnavas. And even though they're on the topmost level of Krishna consciousness, they're relishing the association of other devotees. What to speak of those of us who are less advanced, how much more we should be seeking out and relishing the association of the Vaishnavas. So it's essential. It's not an option. We have to do it. Do or die, literally. It's your choice. Do or die. You die spiritually without you'll dry up. Dry up and blow away without the association of the devotees. So somehow or other, beg, borrow, or steal, you get the association of the devotees. And then your advancement will be continuous, it'll be progressive. They'll be vibrant. Like this. I'll tell you, when I was talking about the internet, I wasn't joking. Personally, every week, I have about 5 or 6 godbrothers who are close to me that I have regular Skype conferences with, video conferences with. And, you know, we speak for an hour or whatever. And every week, I speak to these 5 or 6 devotees. And that's Sangha. That is Vaishnava Sangha. We talk about service, we talk about sadhana, we talk about related things. But it's Sangha, and I find it is very powerful. So there's no excuse. Because I can say, like, I don't have any godbrothers, for example, here, right? I may say that. I can't say that. There's no other disciples of Prabhupada here. So I could say, well, where's my sangha? Where's my association? But because I don't have it with my godbrothers, I seek it out. I make an arrangement. Yes, it requires some, you know, effort to do that. But I think the effort is worth it to do it. So I make the effort. So in the same way, I think each of us has to make that effort to get the association. But I don't feel just from getting their association that I'm benefited. I feel benefited from the association I get from each and every devotee I come in contact with. I feel that I can learn something from any devotee, no matter who they are. So I think we have to be in that mood. Lord Chaitanya was in that mood, and he was our teacher. He taught by example. What did he do? He received the devotees, he personally garlanded them, he personally put chandan paste on their foreheads, he personally fed them, he personally did so many things, service to the devotees like that. So, what to speak of us? So for your long question, I gave a quadrupled sized answer. Any last questions? We're way off time, but that's just me. It's the way it is. Any other questions? Yes. Our Brahmin from Mayapur is now asking a question.
Your Maharaj, speaking of enthusiasm, Krishna just tried to accept our devotion in any kinds of service. So my question is, which is more good to engage? Those who are enthusiastic but not really good at it, or those who are qualified but half-hearted? Something like, I'm not a good cook, but or someone is not a good cook, but enthusiastic to learn or to cook, and someone is not very good cook, but
wants to cook. Enthusiastic to cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, but okay. But you remember what I said, that the Prabhupada mentions in the Nectar of Instruction, the enthusiasm means the endeavor which is executed with intelligence. So if someone is a bad cook but has enthusiasm, then that enthusiasm should propel that person to become a good cook. Because it's not very difficult. It's a science like any other. Right? A certain amount of ghee, a certain amount of spice, a certain length of time, a certain way to stir the vegetables, and so on and so forth. There's a way. So if someone's not good as a cook or anything else, he can go in the association of devotees who have those abilities and learn from them. And then he can utilize his enthusiasm in that way. And as far as a person who's expert and doesn't have his enthusiasm, well, then there you have to trace it back to some basics. Why does a person not have enthusiasm to begin with? It's not just by accident. I wake up one day, I'm not enthusiastic. It's a process. There's a process to become enthusiastic, and there's a process to become unenthusiastic. Meaning by the proper practice of Krishna consciousness, you will be enthusiastic because it is enlivening to the soul. You will be enthusiastic. But if you don't practice in the right way, you won't be enthusiastic. So it's a question of how you practice. So the best thing is if both things are there. You learn to be expert in your service by the association of other devotees who are well versed in that particular service, learn from them, and practice Krishna consciousness properly so you have the enthusiasm to perform that service, you know, very nicely for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. Anything else? Yes? Yeah, I know you like to ask, but I can't hear you. That's the problem. Let's get a mic back there.
What is the essence of serving and knowing and serving your Krishna and his devotees?
What is the essence of
knowing and serving.
Knowing and serving Lord Krishna and his devotees. What's the essence?
Yes, Guru Maharaj.
What is the essence of knowing and serving Lord Krishna and his devotees? Well, the essence is practical action. It's not just lip service. What I mean by lip service is that you just don't talk about it. Oh, I'd love to serve the devotees. So I love to serve the devotees, but the person never does it. It's like, you know, it's like the husband who says to the wife, I love you, I love you, I love you. But he never does anything for the wife. Doesn't give her anything, doesn't provide for her, doesn't do anything. This is called lip service. So we shouldn't be lip service devotees. The essence is that we should practically offer service. It's a practical thing with our body, our minds, and our words. We practically engage and do something. And if you want to do it in the best way, you find out what it is that the person needs or the person wants, what will please him or her. Find out what that is, and you offer that service to that devotee. And as far as Krishna goes, that's an open secret. Krishna tells us throughout Shastra what pleases him. So we already know that. We know it from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, what pleases Krishna. So we should practically do that. We shouldn't just think about it, you know, philosophize about it, or just talk about it. We should actually do it. So the essence is action. Practical action. Do it. Just do it. That's also a motto of Nike, but it's also practical for Krishna consciousness, isn't it? Just do it! Any other questions? No, not one lady has asked a question. Any ladies? Matajis, any questions? Okay. Well, I got two hands at the same time. Start here.
Guru Maharaj, I was about to reserve my question next week. My question is, there are times when enthusiasm starts to dwindle, and you said associate with devotees. But what if you don't, there's a feeling of not hankering that association. But there's a justification that I can regain my enthusiasm by chanting, but sometimes the chanting becomes half-hearted. So should we still call for help? And what is...
And what?
Should we still call for help or call for Krishna's mercy to give that enthusiasm even without the association of the devotees? Can our prayers for Krishna's help?
I got the question. Why does it have to be one or the other? Is it like that? Does it have to be either? It has to be one or the other. Does it have to be, I can just chant on my own and I don't need the association of devotees? Or is it that I'll just have the association of devotees but I won't chant? Why don't you bring the two things together? Why don't you chant and why don't you call out simultaneously for the mercy of the Vaishnavas, Guru, and Krishna? Why don't you have the complete package and not just half the hen, as we were speaking about last week, right? Don't cut the hen in half. Keep the hen whole. Keep it alive. If you want to keep your Krishna consciousness alive, you have to have both things. So, if you're feeling unenthusiastic, then you should take that as a sign. It's a sign of a disease. It's like you have a symptom, right? You have a fever, you have you know, your nose is running, you know there are symptoms, you have a cold, or you have a flu, or something. These are symptoms. So a symptom of a lack of Krishna consciousness is a lack of enthusiasm and wanting to associate with devotees and to serve the devotees, to come to the temple to see the deities, and so on and so forth. This is a sign. So it's a warning sign. And we should take it as such, and we should do something about it. It means we should, the only way to pull ourselves out of that hole is to actually act. You have to just do it. Like I said, just do it. You gotta chant, and you gotta read, and you gotta do all those things, but you have to do them in the association of the devotees. That doesn't mean 24 hours a day necessarily, but it means regular association with the devotees. Regular. Not once a year on Janmashtami, right? Or every 2 years. It should be regular. So again, it's our choice. Honestly, it's our choice. If we want to do it, we'll do it. Because the fact is, everything in this life that we really want to do, we do it. And even though it's difficult, we do it. Right? Isn't that fact? If you want to do something, you do it. If you want to do it bad enough, you'll find the ways and means to do it. So why should Krishna consciousness be any less than that? It should be more than that. So we should be ready to do whatever it takes. Again, we're trying to gain the priceless jewel, the most valuable thing. So we have to pay a bit of a price. And part of the price is we have to push ourselves sometimes beyond the self-imposed limitations that we've placed on ourselves. You know? Where's the limitation? We've set the limitation ourselves. Oh, I can't do this because this and that. We have so many excuses. Our minds come up unlimited. It's, you know, the mind is like a factory. It can churn out so many reasons for why we can't do something. But, you know, the flip side of that is that there are so many reasons for which we can do it. So there's always a negative and there's the positive. So why not use the positive rather than the negative? Just do it. Any other questions? Okay.
Guru Maharaj, this is my first time here. And like very rightly said, whenever you see a newcomer and probably pose the question, what brings you here? And they say that they have come to observe. So I think I have also come to observe. My question to you is, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to frame it right. I'm still not like the other devotees present here. I'm still very stuck in the material world. I have a family. I have a son. I'm thinking about him right now, texting my husband. I'm very, very involved in my family and my material aspect of life. Yet, there is some part of me which is drawn to the Lord as well. I'm very confused because I've also been, raised reading the Bhagavad Gita and, also being told that the essence of Bhagavad Gita also means that you need to do your karma right. So right now my karma is I'm a mother, I'm a wife. Is that my karma? Am I supposed to do it right, take care of my household? Will that be serving the Lord, or would it be, some of us here who are, almost renounced, I'm not sure to what extent, but have renounced most material aspects in life, have limited desires, don't eat spicy food or I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. I'm confused.
I understand.
I'm not sure whether doing my karma would, and also lighting the diya in the evening, sitting by the Lord. I have a small temple as designed for the Lord, and I do it in my way. I read the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I try to read it almost every day. Is that my path right now, or should it be more involvement? I'm just confused, which is why I'm here. So I don't know if I've
you've come to the right place. You've come to the right place. Here's the thing is that there's all the different, there's different aspects, you know, in Hinduism, and a lot of them are like fragments of the whole, and they're not the complete thing. That's why Hinduism is so confusing to many people, even Hindus, what to speak of people who are not Hindus. They really can't make heads or tails of what's going on. So, the thing is, in Vaishnavism, it's very clear that our path is Bhakti Yoga. So, Bhagavad Gita teaches Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Stanga Yoga, Bhakti Yoga. Different paths. But ultimately, at the end, Arjuna, who's very, very qualified, he's heard all of the different paths laid out before him by Krishna. And he answers to Krishna saying that all of the paths that you have mentioned are too difficult for me to follow. He says that I think it would be more, it would be easier for me to control the raging wind than to control my mind through the process of karma, jnana, or stanga yoga. So he opts for bhakti. Because the thing about bhakti is that the means and the end are the same, simultaneous. While we're practicing, we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're following certain principles, we're worshiping the deity, so on and so forth, in the conditioned state. And when we reach the liberated state, we're still engaged in the same activities because they're all transcendental. They're spiritual activities. So, I think that a lot of persons, they have things mixed up, different paths. Karma, because you mentioned karma. So oftentimes there's a mix of karma, jnana, this and that, and whatever. A few demigods on the side and all that kind of thing. I think one has to decide what path one wants to follow. If you want to follow Arjuna, Arjuna chose bhakti. And it's not that Arjuna was a renunciate. He was a householder. He was a kshatriya. He was a warrior. He had to fight in a battle. So, it's not that he was renouncing. And what Krishna taught him was that he should use his position and use his abilities to serve Krishna in that way. And in essence, that Arjuna should fight for Krishna. Should fight for Krishna. Why? Because Krishna wants him to fight. That's the reason. If Krishna wanted him to go to the forest, then he would have gone to the forest. But Krishna wants him to fight. So anybody, it doesn't make a difference what position it is. It's said, whether you're in renounced life, whether you're in household life, doesn't make a difference. But the question is what you do with it. Because in any ashram, in any barna, you can utilize it in Krishna service. But you have to see how to Krishnanize it all. Like you were saying, you read the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Why only the 15th chapter? It's something that your parents might have told you, or family members might have told you, like that. You should read the 15th chapter every day, right?
I've been told that it's the most fruit-giving chapter. As in, if you... Don't ask me what it means. Honestly, I don't know. But I can read Sanskrit, I can read all the chapters, but I'm told that the 15th chapter has more significance in terms of it boils down to what you're supposed to be doing as a human being to serve the Lord.
That's interesting, but not true. Not really. Because in Bhagavad Gita, it's said that the middle six chapters are the most significant. Out of the 18 chapters, the middle six. Because the first are dealing more with karma, and the last more with jnana. And bhakti is kind of sandwiched in the middle. So the middle six are the most important. But to be honest, every word of the Bhagavad Gita is significant. So that's kind of speaking in relative terms. Any chapter is important. So Prabhupada advised that we should read it from cover to cover, not just dwell on one chapter or one verse. We should read all of it, because all of it has meaning. And it's all a story. It has narrative. And it talks about Arjuna's struggle and how the different stages he went through and how he overcame those things and so on and so forth. So it's like that with us. It's like there's no difference, really, in a way. He was facing warriors on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. But we're also facing Maya, the material energy, every day. We're facing our material desires and the many allurements that are out there in the material world. So we're also fighting a battle every day. So we have to see how to best fight, given our particular situation. So you're a household. So you're not meant to renounce your husband or your son or your house or anything else, go to the forest. That's not your dharma. You're not meant to do that. You're in household life. But the fact that you're in household life doesn't mean that you can't turn up the fire of spiritual practice. You just have to add some things to your life, or just some slight adjustments. Like, for example, the regular chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Someone may say, there are so many mantras. That's true. There are so many mantras. But there's only one Maha mantra. This is a Yuga Dharma. This is the process of self-realization for the Kali Yuga. So therefore we say the Maha mantra. So you have to set aside some time every day for chanting on beads, the Maha mantra. And you may start just chanting one round. It takes 7 minutes, 10 minutes. So you can start with that. And as you gain more interest and more taste, then you may increase to two and three and so on and forth. And that is the way to practically apply this. You can cook and offer your food to Krishna. And of course we know we don't offer meat, fish, and eggs to Krishna, right? So if we're in that situation, if we can, we should try to get away from that. So we can offer the things that Krishna wants to offer to him. So it's prasadam. So when we take prasadam, it's spiritually purifying. And you said you have an altar. Make it more of a Vaishnava altar, a bhakti altar, where Krishna is the supreme person, and you have Krishna's devotees there, and so on and so forth. The position of the demigods is they're the servants of Krishna. So they can't be worshipped independent of Krishna. They can be worshipped as Krishna's servants, but they can't be, you know, like I say, the typical Hindu understanding is all gods are the same. But that's not true. Shastra tells us that there's only one supreme person, and that supreme person is Krishna. All the other demigods, no matter how important and how powerful they may be, like Shiva or Brahma or whoever, they're all the servants of Krishna. They do what they're doing as service to Krishna. So we don't independently worship them away from Krishna.
My husband is Catholic.
Well, that's interesting. But that's another thing.
Yeah, I have it all to do with all the lords.
I can understand that.
Jesus,
maybe. Yeah, well, you can do that, but at least you should have Krishna on the highest level. Okay, well, Radha Krishna should be on the highest level, and his devotees should be lower. So you could have Jesus on a lower level as a devotee, just like we have our parampara spiritual masters on a lower level, but they're the devotees. See, our understanding of Jesus, for example, is that he's a servant. He's the son of God. He's not God himself. That's something, again, it's like in Hinduism they don't have it right. In Christianity they don't also understand so clearly the position of Jesus. But Jesus himself said that he's the son of his Father. He sits at the right hand of his Father who art in heaven. He said, hallowed be his name. So he's glorifying his Father. So he's making a distinction between the Father and himself. The Father is the supreme and he's the servant of the supreme. Sometimes they try to say that Jesus is God, but that's not the fact. That's not the way, that's not even the teachings of Jesus, but to speak of other teachings. So, no harm. Jesus can be on the altar. This heaven on a lower level is Krishna's servant. So anyway, I just said there's ways you can Krishnaize. So those are some examples. There are ways. Maybe it can't be done overnight. Maybe it's done incremental adjustments, you know, gradually over time, can be done. But again, it's up to you, really. Again, every jiva has their free will, their independence, and it's up to them what they want. So it depends if you want that. You said in the beginning that you're coming to know more, or coming to understand more, to understand how to increase your spiritual life. So those are some suggestions, practical suggestions. So now it's up to you. Start reading the whole Bhagavad Gita, not just the 15th chapter. And read the purports, not just the verses. Right? Those are some things you can do, but it's up to you. I think we'll stop here because it's 1:45. Way past time. Okay? Thank you all. I think next week John Lenomar should be here. So I'm not sure exactly if he'll be lecturing here or Munavadweep down, one of the two places. So I won't be coming here next week, but the following week we may do a program together here. But we'll have to see. But that there's some plan like that. We may do that. So, until we meet again, Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.